Welcome to episode 37 of the SWNZ podcast, the podcast for New Zealand Star Wars fans. My name is Matt.
And my name is Christy.
Starting off our podcast today with a news roundup, I want to talk about a quite interesting interview that Taika Waititi did with the Wired website, Wired magazine website, which covered a few interesting points and touched on just a little bit, not much, on his future Star Wars film. This article is in particular interesting because it opened by mentioning that Taika was recording this interview from his house in Auckland, New Zealand. We kind of knew that he's a busy guy, he's all over the show at the moment, but it's fun to sort of know that he's in New Zealand, working from New Zealand, writing and creating from New Zealand just at this point. And as you know, here on SWNZ, we love talking about Kiwi's involvement in Star Wars, so let's just have a little bit of a look at some of the things that came up out of this conversation. First up, we know that the technology from The Mandalorian, the stagecraft technology where you have sort of computer-generated background imagery moving in real time as filming is taking place, is being expanded and used in other productions. And Taika was obviously one of the first people as a director of The Mandalorian Season 1, one of the first people to really get a hands-on experience with that. And that's benefited him because he's gone on to use this stagecraft technology in his production of Thor, Love and Thunder. And it's kind of interesting sort of knowing that he's got this expanded toolkit of high-tech filming techniques. And there are a couple of others that he's been using on these Marvel films as well that are very interesting. So he's really becoming quite a, you know, an asset in terms of being a Hollywood director with experience with new and interesting technology and techniques. Yeah, and on that note, the article also talks about other technology that he is using, how has been using on Thor, Love and Thunder, technology from a company called Satellite Lab and technology that they call Plate Light, which uses the principle of using very high speed lighting rigs that can move faster than the speed of sound, literally, and they pair that with slow motion footage. And this plate light technology is used to capture multiple lighting setups simultaneously within a single shot, Taika says. And when you break down that footage into increments of 24 frames per second, you can actually choose the kind of lighting you want. You get all the individual kinds of lighting captured, and you can choose which lighting setup you want in post-production. So that's some quite interesting technology that's going on at the moment. But the most interesting thing from this interview was a couple of tiny little snippets of information about his Star Wars film, about which we know very little to this point. No title, no time frame, no point in the continuity or any such thing. But he does mention that he has basically got a story in mind, so that presumably means he knows where it kind of fits in to the Star Wars continuity. He jokingly says it's still in the exterior space introductory stage, referring to the sort of setup for an opening scene for a movie. But he does reiterate that he's got a story, he's excited by it, he declares that it feels very much like him. The question was posed to him, has it been a challenge to marry his irreverent tone with the operatically sincere Star Wars universe? He replies, I tend to go down that little sincerity alleyway in my films. I like to fool the viewer into thinking, ha, it's this, and then get them going, damn, you made me feel something. So, I mean, we've seen a number of Taika's films, and he does have some breadth. His film Thor Ragnarok was one of my favourite Marvel films, frankly. So I've got confidence that he's going to get a good Star Wars film out of his style, but there's a lot of unknowns about this at this point.
Even though his interview is obviously not really going to give us that much in these early stages, it's just nice being reminded that there is a Star Wars film being actively worked on. We know that there are a couple in the sort of planning announced stages, but I feel like Taika's might be one of the ones that we see first. Certainly Patty Jenkins' film was announced to be the next one coming up, but I feel like Taika is actively working on it by his comments, so that's exciting to see.
Yeah, I mean, it is super exciting. Taika seems to pop up everywhere you look just at the moment in terms of film productions and cameo roles and secondary roles and so forth. I do like the fact that he is going to be helming a Star Wars film and seeing where that goes. And I've talked about it before on podcasts. He's got a strong connection to New Zealand and tends to use Kiwis and people he's worked with before in his films. So there's a good chance that his involvement in a Star Wars films means we'll see other Kiwi celebrities and other aspects of, you know, sort of New Zealand culture injected into it in one way or another.
Obviously, New Zealanders have been involved in many Star Wars productions going back many years, but in sort of the recent year and a half, it sort of feels like the New Zealanders in Star Wars productions have been able to bring a little bit more New Zealand into it. Obviously, Temuera was able to bring more of his cultural heritage into his portrayal of Boba Fett that was not really there in Django, apart from the accent and his look. and Michelle Ang bringing a very Kiwi accent into her portrayal of Omega. It sort of feels like we're getting a little bit more representation in the Star Wars universe. So I can only hope that Taika will continue and put some Kiwi actors, some sort of touches that are uniquely sort of New Zealand.
Yeah, no, that's true and interesting. I mean, Bodie Taylor, who played the clone troopers in Attack of the Clones, he actually got the job in a large part because of his skills with the Taiha, but he never really got to portray that. We've seen him in real life working with the Taiha and lightsabers, as we have with Tim, but it never really came through in the prequel films. But clearly they are leaning heavily on Tim's skill with traditional Maori weapons and so forth in the Mandalorian and the Book of Boba Fett. And yeah, that I think that's significant. That's a really cool thing from our point of view. So as we say, Tyke is a very busy man at the moment. He's probably going to be a little bit of time before we hear more information about the Star Wars films, because he's got a lot on his plate. He's making a sequel to What We Do in the Shadows, apparently, and an animated remake of Flash Gordon, animated series from Roald Dahl for Netflix, and a live-action adaptation of Akira for the big screen, I believe. So a little bit of time before he gets to really get stuck into the Star Wars film, but if he's got a framework for it at this point of time, I'm sure the ideas will be gestating as he goes along. Another little bit of news that caught my attention because it popped up on StarWars.com. There was a very cool preview, quite a few pages of comic preview pages from War of the Bounty Hunters number 3 on StarWars.com. This looks like quite a fun series because, in particular, and this isn't a spoiler because it is talked about on StarWars.com, they talk about Kira and her role subsequent to her appearance in Solo, A Star Wars Story, and this story arc is actually set post Empire Strikes Back, so it's really interesting to know what she's up to at that point in time in the Star Wars continuity. The War of the Bounty Hunters miniseries is a 5-issue miniseries that began with a prequel, War of the Bounty Hunters Alpha 1. It's actually a crossover event between Bounty Hunters, Darth Vader, Dr. Aphra, and the Star Wars comic itself. Which is fun in many regards, but it does make it a little bit challenging, I find, to really sort of get stuck into it if you're not following all the comics all the time. But hopefully the 5-issue miniseries of War of the Bounty Hunters is something that works well as a standalone unit of comic storytelling, because it's one I'd really like to read and learn more about that, about Kira's role and the underworld during the post-Empire Strikes Back timeline. If you happen to be reading the comics on an ongoing basis and have started reading the War of the Bounty Hunters, let us know how you actually feel about the story arc and whether or not you recommend it. We'd be keen to hear other people's perspectives on that. Moving on to product announcements and store reports, there's a few things to talk about from the past week. One that really jumped out just coming out yesterday, Thursday, New Zealand time. New Zealand Mint, a couple of days back, revealed a new, what they're calling Faces of the Empire line and coin, starting off with Darth Vader as a 1-ounce silver coin priced at $144. Now, they've got so much going on at the moment in terms of sort of coin series, new and old, and sometimes going back to some of the older lines and adding to them. But I think this is the first time they've actually revealed an entire line and all the coins that are going to be coming out in one hit in the way that they did just yesterday. They revealed that the Faces of the Empire line is actually going to have 16 coins over 2 years. And each of these is a little two-dimensional representation of a Imperial trooper or Imperial character, basically. So over 2 years, we're going to get Vader, Stormtrooper, TIE Pilot, Scout Trooper, Snow Trooper, Death Trooper, Scarif Shore Trooper, Hover Tank Pilot, Kylo Ren, First Order Stormtrooper, First Order TIE Pilot, First Order Flame Trooper, First Order Snow Trooper, a Patrol Trooper from Solo, and Phase 1 and Phase 2 Clone Troopers. They laid these all out in a social media post so you could see them in their entirety, and it's quite a tempting line, but yeah, 16 coins over 2 years is quite a commitment, and some of them are definitely cooler than others in the way they translate into this two-dimensional sort of helmet face representation. But the Darth Vader coin is up for pre-order now at $144.
It's quite an impressive range, and I think Imperial helmets have always been a popular sort of collecting focus for fans, but it is interesting that there are a couple of omissions that we thought would have been included, like there is no AT-AT pilot helmet in this line, so maybe...
No Royal Guard.
Yeah, maybe they're going to see if... They're going to keep going at the end. Maybe there'll be more. But 16 coins spread over 2 years. That means that it won't be quite a fast-paced one to keep up with. Obviously, with the Darth Vader coin being priced at 144, we can assume that the rest of the range will be at a similar, if not identical, price point. So that's going to add up a little bit over 16 coins, but at least it's going to be spaced out. So if you want to dive in, the Vader coin has a mintage of 10,000. So these aren't quite as limited or will sell out in the blink of an eye than, say, some of the other ones like the Chibi coins. So it'll be interesting to see how popular these are with fans.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, they've got a lot of ongoing series, and they've released a number of series over time. And when they release series, we can often infer what the other coins are because they're working through all the trilogy posters or whatever, and they've talked about upcoming releases. But this is really interesting to see them all completely laid out in advance. I don't think they come with any sort of display case for them in their entirety, but that would actually be cool, quite a cool feature or add-on that they could really throw into the mix to make them more desirable, but I don't think that's something that's coming just yet. And yeah, we talk about New Zealand Mint a lot in the podcast, and not least Devin Zed, because they are based in Auckland. So don't forget that a little while back we actually did an interview with one of their marketing staff, talking about how they work with the Star Wars franchise and how they craft and create these coins and where they're made and so forth. And that's kind of fun. That is available on SDMZ. I'll put a link down below. Check out that interview with New Zealand Mint that we did a little while back now. There was quite a bit of excitement when a number of Bad Batch Black Series collectors got their 6-inch Wrecker shipped from Mighty Ape during the past week. This deluxe figure, he's larger than the other Bad Batch figures that have come out so far in terms of his packaging, was being received early because a number of other sellers still have these listed as showing up in November, but Mighty Ape has managed to get them in hand and shipped out, and he is still available to buy if you don't have him pre-ordered right now on Mighty Ape. Get him shipped straight away.
I know for us, we've certainly noticed our desire for Bad Batch collectibles going up with each successive episode. So I do think that if you're even considering some of the Bad Batch lines, obviously if you get one Bad Batch clone, you kind of want to get the set. But because some of the characters were released right at the start of the series, they will be harder to find once the series finishes. So you'll have to grab these quickly.
It's a very tempting set. So what have we got so far? Hunter's out. The Bad Batch version of Crosshair's out, and the Imperial version's coming. Now Wrecker is out. We know that there's a Tech on the way. We know there's an Omega on the way. There's Captain Rex. There's Rampart. And there's an Elite Squad clone trooper. I think that's pretty much it from all of the Bad Batch Black Series 6-inches. But we're expecting Echo. I don't think we've seen Echo just yet in terms of a picture. But yeah, like you say, the Bad Batch, just by itself in particular, would be a very, very cool set. And maybe they'll add on some other characters beyond that.
I think it'd be fun to see one or two of the Kaminoans.
Yep.
Because of the main role that they play.
Fennec Shand as well.
Yes, that would be cool.
Another wave of, for the book readers amongst you, another wave of the Essential Legends collection books has been announced. This is the third wave. There are 4 books in this lineup. Now, the Essential Legends is going back and republishing, you know, older era expanded universe books. A number of these are actually all continuously available with the Legends banner on them from publishers, but this new collection is putting them out with new covers and a new format, and it's quite a nice clean way just to expand your library. And there's they're working through the most loved, the titles that have had the best response along the way. So if you're looking at more Star Wars material to read, they're a really good choice. This new wave has the final book of the Darth Bane trilogy, Dynasty of Evil, the Darth Plagueis one-off title, the Kenobi one-off title, and the second book in the X-Wing series, X-Wing Wedge's Gamble. I personally have read all of those books when they first came out in first releases, and yeah, I recommend any of them as good series. And even if they are sort of Legends expanded universe content now that maybe doesn't fit in perfectly with current canon, I personally don't have a lot of difficulty just compartmentalizing and reading and enjoying them as stories, even if they don't match perfectly with the continuity now. Yeah, so some really good books there to choose from.
I know when Disney bought Star Wars, people were worried that a lot of the older content was essentially going to be put locked away in the Disney vault, that they were going to sort of put the older stuff away and start with a clean slate. So I think it's really exciting for fans of the classic expanded universe content that they are continuing to publish them and make them available so that you don't need to go hunting in the scarce secondhand bookshop market to try and track down some of these great Star Wars stories.
And sometimes I don't mind having more than one copy of a book, a reading copy and a display copy, just like collecting other Star Wars collectibles, frankly. It's nice just having good Star Wars books on a bookshelf. And like I say, these ones have all come with new cover art and a slightly new formatting, which makes them quite a fun collection in their own right. All right, well, there's been a number of posters that we've talked about on Mighty 8 before, but we found some quite neat ones also at Cotton On/Typo stores. And in fact, there's a deal on at the moment. There's two posters to choose from, a Millennium Falcon blueprint and a Mandalorian poster. You can get them $18 each, but just right now you can also get both of them for $20. Quite cool designs. You like that Falcon one, don't you?
Yeah, it's unique. I haven't seen that sort of print before.
And a couple of exclusive pops are showing up at Funko Pop vinyl retailers around the country from the Funcon Summer 2021 exclusive range. We have Ray Jakku on a brown base, coming in at $26 to $27, and the Imperial Commando, a white armored figure, coming also in at $27. Okay, time to talk about the Bad Batch episode 15 from last week, The Return to Kamino. Now, we went into this episode knowing that it was part one of a two-part finale, so we weren't expecting a satisfying conclusion, to put it bluntly. We were expecting the story to be wrapped up. It was a good episode, but it's tasked with dealing some very major events in the Star Wars timeline, and that made it quite an impactful episode all up. So in this episode, Hunter is taken to Poker City on Kamino, where the Empire has evacuated most personnel and eliminated some, we've been led to believe. Crosshair, knowing that the rest of Bad Batch are probably coming to rescue Hunter, activates Hunter's comlink to lure them into a trap. But they're able to get to Kamino because Omega shows a hidden entrance into Nala Se's secret laboratory, and they're able to sort of approach covertly. Nala Se's secret laboratory is interestingly where the Bad Batch were actually all created, as was Omega. And a little bit of a surprise plot point was revealed here when Omega talks about watching Bad Batch being created. And we'll come back and talk about that in a minute. So along with the friendly droid AZI-3, Bad Batch find Hunter, who tries to convince Crosshair to have his inhibitor chip removed. And then a real sort of shocker, Crosshair reveals that it has already been removed, and that he's working with the Empire without being influenced by an inhibitor chip. That was quite a out-of-the-blue story twist, I think, in some ways. And they're not... He, for both Hunter's point of view and the audience's point of view, they deliberately make you a little bit uncertain as to whether or not he's telling the truth. He doesn't say when it was done. He's got scarring on the side of his head from the earlier incident with the Venator-class cruiser engine blast that he received to the face, which means they can't actually tell if he's got a scar to confirm if he's had the chip removed. And we're left just a little bit up in the air in terms of how to interpret that bit of information. And the episode kind of wraps up with the Bad Batch, Hunter included, being able to escape, but the really sort of punch to the gut finale is the destruction of Topoka City by the orbiting Imperial cruisers.
This was quite a dramatic episode. There were some fun moments, some things that we kind of knew were going to happen, but it was kind of devastating to see Topoka City being bombed from the Star Destroyers. I was always a little bit suspicious about what the Empire had for the plans, because it felt like they were going to phase out the clones. And I guess when you sort of sit back and think about it in hindsight, they were never going to let that sort of cloning technology, the ability to create an army, fall into competitors' hands. They're never going to want, you know, the rebellion to be able to create a clone army to fight up against the Empire. So they were obviously going to do something to stop anybody else using it if they weren't. But it was still sort of quite gutting watching it being blasted. And of course, it made it even sort of more so because the Bad Batch are there watching their home being destroyed. Yeah. It wasn't just sort of something that the Empire did in secret and nobody sort of was watching it happen. Obviously, we see the Bad Batch somewhat trapped there as well. The episode ends with them having to sort of run back inside to sort of try and escape the orbital strikes.
I think it was interesting the way it panned out in its entirety. I mean, those stark, unmoving scenes where they just moved around showing Topoka City abandoned. I mean, as we know, Topoka City is the capital of planet Kamino. There's, at its peak, millions of Kaminoans living there and working there, which is, you know, a lot to fully evacuate. I presume a number of them have gone to other locations on Camino. We know that even though Tobago City is the capital, it's not the only settlement on Camino. There's, according to Stowell's complete locations, about 1 billion Caminoans living around the planet. But that starkness of the empty rooms, and then what looks like basically complete destruction, there's not going to be anything left by the time they're finished, was a big moment.
Yeah, we saw some of those sort of starship blasts hitting the poles, the structures, yep, keeping the city up in the water. So it's not just being bombed, it's also going to be sunk to the bottom of the ocean, which we assume is quite deep,
yep,
because of the large sea creatures that live on Camino. So I did enjoy Omega sort of taking the lead a little bit on this. She knew things about Camino.
She was in her element.
Yeah, she knew how to trigger the secret platform that nobody knew. As Tech points out, the sort of secret tunnels are not on any schematics. They were things that even he didn't know about. And she obviously knows a lot of secrets and some of the things that the Caminoans have been doing sort of unbeknownst to probably even the Galactic Republic as well as the Empire. So we see her sort of being helpful. Not in some episodes, she's kind of, the Bad Batch see her as a bit of a, not quite a weak link, but she's not able to contribute to the same level. She's obviously younger, shorter.
Well, she's younger in terms of development, but let's just talk about that for a moment, yeah, because she would have been created, she's in her very early teens, so she would have been created before the Clone Wars. The duration of the Clone Wars, what, about 10 years?
Yeah.
So she was created before the Clone Wars, whereas Bad Batch were created and trained subsequent to that.
Yeah. As she points out, when they finally get to the secret lab, she was there when the Bad Batch was created. So without additional information, I'm inclined to believe that she was created possibly at a similar time to Boba Fett, that she is an unaltered clone, because if she had age acceleration, then she would be fully grown. If she, as she says, was there when the Bad Batch was created and they are full grown adults and she's still quite young and shorter than them. So she's almost like, I don't think she could be seen as a twin sister to Boba Fett, but probably about the same age. And it's interesting that the Caminoans were doing secret things that early in the clone trooper production line. We don't really know if there are any others like her, these little one-offs that were created just for sort of experimental reasons. Obviously, Nala Se seemed quite attached to Omega. She didn't want her used for sort of scientific experimentation. She wanted her sort of, you know, as a child almost, you know, as a family member, because they would have been living together on Camino for quite some years, you know, 10 years or more at this point. And it's interesting to see that is why she's connected to the Bad Batch. She doesn't just know about them. She was literally there watching them created.
Because they were created specifically in that lab, unlike other regular clone troopers. They were shipped off from that lab once they started their development and training. But they have a different timeline to other clone troopers. And I think we could have probably presumed a lot of this because we knew Omega's age, we knew the duration of the Clone Wars, but it still puts a little bit of an interesting twist on the relationship between the Bad Batch and Omega, because along the way they've been looking after her, but their capacity to look after her is really just a consequence of their training and their skills and their background rather than their age per se.
Yeah, in terms of actual calendar days, she's actually the big sister.
Yeah.
That she's actually a fair bit older. She would have to be old enough to be aware of what was being done in the lab, so she could have been a full, you know, 10 years old by the time that they were being created and sort of watching them, knowing that she is a very unique clone and they are very unique clones. So she would have that extra bond as well as being from the same lab. Obviously, they don't really have parents as such. Django is probably the closest to a parent, but without any kind of parental sort of solid connections, she's looking to the Bad Batch as the only other family that she has, being that sort of unique developed clone. So I thought that was a really neat moment sort of fully put out there for the fans to know how everything fits together, rather than just sort of speculating on how she's connected to the Bad Batch.
And as you say, I really did quite enjoy seeing her take the lead and having the having the knowledge that they didn't have access to, and she was able to really contribute in that way. I thought that was portrayed quite nicely as well. And let's just talk about Crosshair just for a moment, because as I say, the revelations and his behavior was really quite interesting if not slightly confusing and open-ended, because they came face to face with him in the training arena after having all been lured there. And that's when the bombshell was dropped that he'd already had his inhibitor chip removed. He made the statement that he was going to give them something that they never gave him, you know, a chance. They presumed that he'd gone dark side effectively, but he was sort of giving them the benefit of the doubt, even though he had them all up against the wall pretty much, because he was backed up by the elite squad troopers at that point. He shot the elite squad troopers. He was stunned in order for them to escape, but still the way that all played out was very, very interesting and open-ended.
One of the elite squad troopers that wasn't in the room at the time when Crosshair sort of used reflectors to take out the rest of them in one go, reports back to Rampart that sort of what's going on, because they see that the other troopers are down and Bad Batch are there with him. And Rampart makes a comment like it sort of doesn't matter whether Crosshair's plan failed. So we know that Crosshair had a plan that he had relayed to Rampart. We don't know exactly what that was. We thought he was just sort of out to kill them or capture them to sort of turn them over to the Empire. But in those scenes in that training room, it feels like he had some other, like whether he had told the Empire that he could get them back and turn them, because he seemed to really be trying to convince them that they're good soldiers, let's protect the galaxy by being the elite squad for the Empire. It seems like he really doesn't want to kill them. Mm. He wants them back as brothers on his side. But then Hunter has the same passion to try and pull Crosshair back to his brothers. They're just fully entrenched into
their respective positions. Yeah. And we know Bad Batch isn't going to turn to the Empire. The big, huge question amongst all the other aspects is whether or not Crosshair is going to turn.
There's a point where the Bad Batch is trying to convince Crosshair that the Empire will do away with clone troopers, and he says, no, we're elite, they'll always have a use for us. But at the end, when the Empire is bombing Topoka City, he is knocked unconscious with the stun blast.
Yes.
So in the next episode, he's going to have to deal with the knowledge that the Empire tried to kill him as well as the other clones by just bombing the city, that they didn't care about just getting rid of him because, you know, they don't rank as high as the Empire as he thinks they do.
Yeah, and assuming he believes them. I mean, if he's unconscious, he may twist in his mind exactly how things played out, but yeah, that's the biggie that's going to have to be resolved, I think.
Yeah, but there was some really interesting moments in that conversation between the two of them and sort of how events unfolded from the two different points of view, and they obviously do care for each other. And I would love to see Crosshair sort of redeemed and brought back into the fold, but I don't know if that's exactly what the showrunners, that maybe they're setting us up to believe that that could happen, or whether it's going to be quite devastating and he's going to be completely within the Empire's grasp at the end of all of this. So
Star Wars is often about redemption, but it's never a hard and fast rule, and there's nothing saying that they need to keep following that pattern.
Well, and as we've seen with the likes of Vader and Kylo Ren, redemption often comes just before death, you know, just enough. So I'm a little bit worried for him. I think it would be a neat dynamic to sort of bring him back in, and then you'd have sort of an interesting starting off point for season two, having the Bad Batch all complete. But I'm super excited to see what the finale will bring. I know it's probably going to give us a lot of loose threads. It's not going to wrap up everything, but I'm kind of hoping it's not just a complete, and tune in next time, you know, to like just not give us
the finale, like, full conclusion. The finale's going to be bittersweet. It's going to give us information, but it's also going to be the end of the run we've had. 15, and it'll be the 16th really, really good episode. Then we're left with another bit of a, you know, gap. So hopefully we'll have something else to talk about very soon about what's coming up. So looking forward to the episode, not looking forward to the series being over just yet.
Yeah. I wish there were more episodes, but I do, I can feel the cadence of the storytelling, and I think it does work well. We're building up to something big. I hope it's a slightly longer than normal episode. I know people tend to look at the run times for each episodes, and we always want just a few more minutes more of Star Wars, so I hope it's not too brief before jumping us off to a hiatus until the next season.
Would definitely be good. I'm totally, it's totally made me want to go back and watch the earlier Bad Batch episodes, season 7. So maybe between, well, we'll talk about the final episode in the next podcast, but possibly after that, we'll do our homework and have a look at some of the season 7 episodes, the introduction of, you know, the establishment of Bad Batch. And yeah, maybe that's something we'll talk about in podcasts as well, just as a little bit of a flashback. And maybe people who have really enjoyed watching the Bad Batch series will go back and look at those Clone Wars episodes as well, just to keep the ball rolling on that topic. But on that note, that's about it for this installment. I guess we're done doing talking. If you have any thoughts on topics we've discussed today, we're definitely keen to hear them. Leave a comment on the YouTube page or on our website page for this podcast. But thank you for tuning in. We appreciate you taking your time to listen to us share our passion for Star Wars. Stay tuned to our website, swnz.co.nz, for Star Wars news for New Zealanders, and another podcast episode next week and every Friday. And don't forget, you can jump on over to either our Facebook group or the SWNZ message boards to discuss all the latest Star Wars news with other Kiwi fans. Thank you for listening.
And may the Force be with you.